it's a surprise, you know, is what it is. All these years down the line, when you suddenly, 25 years later, you realize that the thing has become a standard to some extent.
Ride My Seesaw is really about me growing up and trying to relate.
Hi, I'm Denny Somach, and this is The Rock Podcast. I want to introduce my co-host, Anita Gevinson.
Hey, Denny.
How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Okay. A little bit different this week. I was going through the archives, and I found an interview with Roger Waters that was done back in 1990, right around the time that he did the first Wall concert when the Berlin Wall had come down. And I remember I was over there covering it, and we did this interview, and actually I had a British correspondent, Mal, at the time, and he's actually the one that's on the interview 3 weeks before the concert. So it's like being a fly on the wall. You get to hear exactly, he's still planning what he's going to do. And of course, that concert has since come out on DVD, and you know, hundreds of thousands of people attended, and it was pretty amazing. But you know, I was thinking, and we were talking earlier, you want to explain what the Berlin Wall was?
Well, you know, the Berlin Wall was finally, I think 8 months before this came out, it was finally deconstructed, but it had been around since the 60s and it divided the country. And it was just, you know, we talk about the wall today and we kind of joke about it, but this was just so awful. And you know, ideologically, it divided the country as well. And this was a guarded wall. I mean, this, you know, families were torn apart, and it was a huge deal when it came down. And I believe that Roger Waters said he would never perform the wall. Yeah. So that's what was part of his motivation for this very ambitious product, the live concert. The guest artist, because he was the only member of Pink Floyd in Berlin, 21st of July, 1990. I can't imagine where I was during this, but I don't remember any. I know I had just recently moved to LA, so that right. That, you know, I was probably trying to decipher the Cure from, you know, other, you know, who the Cure, you know, right. Learning new bands and right. Having a new life out in LA, but I had no idea that this happened at all. But thanks to YouTube and a sweet apple gummy, right. I was just there. I watched the whole thing.
Van Morrison does partially steal the show.
Van Morrison is incredible.
He does. There are
moments.
Yeah,
there are moments in the show that I need to watch over and over again. They're, you know, without even knowing about them a week ago, they become some of my favorite moments. Joni Mitchell is incredible. Sinead O'Connor. Well, Sinead O'Connor, you can see that there was the beginnings of what unfortunately has plagued her through the years, definitely has some real problems. But man, she does a mother. She does a thing with mother that like when they say, you know, people make it their own. It's kind of like, you know, Paula Abdul, I think, coined that phrase, but she really does. And during the show itself, there was a full stage blackout. And so they wanted her to do it over and she refused. I think Roger Waters called her the most difficult person he ever had to work with ever. So they used the rehearsal footage, Rick Danko and
members of the band.
Yes.
Garth Hudson, Levon Helm.
Yeah. He plays sax. He plays accordion. It's really, it's unbelievable. Levon Helm. Yeah. So I suggest, you know, edible optional. I suggest everybody checks this out because this was a major, major thing. And I can't believe you were there. That's so cool.
Yeah. And originally Peter Gabriel was going to be on and Springsteen and Clapton, but that didn't happen. Even Rod Stewart was rumored for a while. But obviously, you know, it turned out okay. Van Morrison, Sinead O'Connor, Cyndi Lauper, as you mentioned, Marianne Faithfull,
Thomas Dolby looking crazy as shit, man. You should, Thomas Dolby, I don't know what he was thinking. You know, it was, I guess, you know, it was still the '80s really, Jerry Hall, Tim Curry. There's a side to the whole thing that's very Rocky Horror.
Let me set this up. First of all, while I was going through the interview, I got a call from John Lodge of the Moody Blues. He wanted to fill us in on what he's got a new single out, a new EP. So we talked to him. So you'll hear that after Roger Waters. And then I heard from Gary Brooker of Procol Harum, who has a new EP out also. And it's a return to the classic Procol Harum sound. So we're going to hear from both of those guys right after we hear from Roger. But let me set this up. So we're in Roger's warehouse somewhere outside of London, and I'm looking around and there's all these boxes, and I lean over and I say, well, what's in all these boxes? And he goes, well, these are all the cells that from the wall of the movie, the Gerard Scarfe drawings that the cartoon was made of. I thought, wow, that's amazing. Boxes and boxes of them. They're all sitting there. So maybe someday he'll sell them off. I don't know.
Yeah, for you, that's like Keith Richards finding cocaine or heroin in a warehouse. Yeah. That's your drug of choice right there. So Did you like, tell him how what he should do with them? Or
No. I don't know if you've ever met him, but he's not the easiest guy in the world to have a conversation with. He's all business and... You know, but anyway, this interview is a gem. So let's get into this. This is our interview with Roger Waters. And I think it was the last week of June in 1990, right before that concert. So here it is.
Just under a month's time, you will be staging what I think you could say is one of the most extravagant, well thought out productions, live productions that we've ever seen. It's an open air concert in Berlin, right on the wall. What are your feelings about it now? I mean, it's a conceptual idea that's now in the making, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm too busy to think about it now. I just get up in the morning and start work. And when I'm too tired to go any longer, I go to bed and get some sleep. And then I get up in the morning and start work again. And most of the work, unfortunately, is being on the telephone or attending meetings, you know. I'm very happy to say that on Tuesday I start rehearsing again, which is great.
Now, I've been down to those rehearsals, fortunate enough to just poke my head round the door for half an hour, and I've been listening to you playing with some superb musicians, people who are no strangers to you either. You've actually worked with the likes of Annie Fairweather Lowe and so on before. Tell us a little bit about the musical side of the wall performance that you're doing in Berlin.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm working with musicians who I've worked with before. There are seven of us. And we rehearsed a month ago. We finished a month ago. Learned all the songs, worked out how to do it all, worked out all the lengths and timings. And because as this is going out live TV, in England we know we're going out live network TV on July the 21st in the evening. I don't know if a deal's been struck in America yet, so I don't know... where people will be able to see the show. But because it's live, we have to know how long it's going to be and how long things are going to last and so on and so forth. And so the show is being run off a multi-track tape recorder and off SMPTE code. So we're working to clicks most of the time so that what we play is in sync, A, with the visual effects, and B... it means that the guy who's directing, or the three guys who are directing the television show know exactly when to put in special effects that we've recorded beforehand and that kind of thing. But it's the band that I've mentioned, and we now have confirmed the Symphony Orchestra, which is an East Berlin Symphony Orchestra and chorus.
When I saw the show that you did at Earl's Court, I think in 85, it was the last time that you performed The Wall. 1981 you performed The Wall at Earl's Court. And that was the last time I think you did it in Britain. Indeed, possibly the last time you ever performed it.
Yeah.
You were confined theatrically by the building. The actual measurements of Earl's Court Arena prohibited you from building a bigger wall or from having this or having that. This time around... you've had the freedom to expand the thoughts that you've always had for this performance and, yeah. and go crazy?
Well, hardly, because I'm prohibited by a very, very tight budget. You mentioned that it was an extravagant show. I guess in one sense it is. It's very expensive to put on, and it's very large in its in the ideas that involve. The wall that we're building is 200 yards wide and 6 stories high. But there's nothing extravagant about it. We're fighting for every penny. And there are budget meetings twice a week. And if we start going over budget in one area, we have to find it in another area. Because at the end of the day, the show is being promoted by the Memorial Fund. And we're trying to make some money for them and to raise awareness about the Memorial Fund. And so we have to be very careful what we spend.
When you finished performing The Wall, I imagine that was the last time you ever thought you would do it again. Here yeah. you are again in 1990, the beginning of a decade, bringing all that back into the present.
Yeah.
Why? Is it because this particular charity has inspired you to...
Well, I did an interview about the making of the album a couple of years ago. I can't remember the radio station. It's a station out of Texas, anyway. About the making of the album, at the end of it, he said, "Will you ever do the show again?" I said, "Nope." And he said, "Oh, come on, lots of people love it." And I said, "Well, that's difficult. Indoors, it's uneconomic, and as it's an attack on stadium rock, to a certain extent anyway, and my disenchantment with that activity, I couldn't really go and do that again." And I said at the end of the interview, I might put it on in Berlin, outdoors, as an act of celebration. When they tear down the Berlin Wall. And I confess I thought that was probably 10 years away and that everybody would have forgotten. But in fact, it had actually happened 18 months after I did that interview, much to my surprise, and I think everybody else's as well. And people had heard this interview and it had been reported, and I'd already been approached by Leonard in September. The Wall didn't come down until November the 9th, and in September they'd come and approached me and asked if I might be prepared to put it on. So we were looking at other venues and ways that we could possibly do it, but we were floundering a bit. And then when the Wall came down in Berlin, we flew out the next day and had a look at sites, and that was it.
Putting the show on in Berlin, or anywhere for that matter, an open-air performance of this type, with, you were mentioning, you have an orchestra. Mm. But did you mention the East German Orchestra?
Yeah. East Berlin Symphony
Orchestra. East Berlin. Yourself, your musicians, you've got balloons, dirigibles. Tell us all the theatrical things that are going on. It's incredible, this event, isn't it?
Well, I think the only dirigible will be a blimp with a camera in it. It won't be actually taking part in the show. Mm. We have now had confirmation from Whitehall that we can use 2 Lynx helicopters from the 7th Airborne British Army Airborne Division for the beginning of another Brick 2, so that finally the helicopters before you stand still, and it will be real ones instead of just on tape. I'm still desperately trying to get permission to fly B-17s oversight at the beginning of the show, but that, I confess, is looking increasingly doubtful.
Where will they come from? The Confederate Air Force or someone like that?
Well, no, there's one in France and there's one in England, in fact. Mm. They were both B-17s that were used in the making of the Memphis Belle. Mm. But they're very expensive because, you know, they insist on a crew of 6 and they cost so much to fly here and that and that. You know, for a 30-second fly past, it would cost about 30 grand by the end of the day. So, you know, in a way, I'm hoping the permission doesn't come through, because then we can use that 30,000 for something else. And you know, it's at least prompted me to put the sound of those Second World War 4-engine bomber. The sound of the engines is, in fact, what's really gets to you. You know, even if you close your eye, when one flies by, even if you close your eyes, you still get it. You know, because it's that sound of those piston engines.
And the vibration. And the,
yeah. yeah. Anyway, so there's that. The Russians. Are providing us with. It's called the combined. No, it's called the combined Soviet. The marching band of the combined Soviet forces in Germany. There's 100 of them. They have now got the music, and they've got their parts. We've sent them their parts, and I should be going to see them the week after next to see if they've learnt it or not.
Who's singing Another Brick in the Wall?
That is under wraps. In fact, I don't know. It could be one of about four different people, or maybe even sets of people.
Because for the album, you used a school choir, didn't you? Very English, very rural.
Well,
I'm
trying to get the choir from the school over there, from the same school as the ones who did the original one, which is Islington Green's Junior School. And how that's coming on, I don't know, because I set it in motion about 3 weeks ago, and I haven't asked them, because I haven't got time. You know, this. You know, that's one thing I've said. Okay, look, you go to Islington Green Junior School and try and get 30 kids who are like, it's like 10 years on. And I also suggested them, why don't you try and find out what's happened to the ones who were there? They're all 20 now, 20, 21.
Right.
You know, where are they now? It's rather an interesting story.
It is, isn't it? You know, and whether
and what do they think? And they, you know, they've lived through the 80s from the age of 10 or 11 to the age of 20, 21. Be interesting to hear what, you know. And what did they think of that then? And, you know, all that. That's so, whether anybody's done anything, I've no idea.
Aside from the theatrical aspect of the show, the bands, the aeroplanes overflying the site, etc., and the building of this enormous stage, you've also had the logistical problems of dealing with not one government, but two governments, because effectively Berlin, although its wall is being knocked down, it is... still a divided city. There are two councils and two governments and so on.
Yeah.
How have you gotten on with that aspect of cooperation from both the East Berliners as well as, of course, the West Berlin government where you're actually performing the show?
Well, don't forget, West Berlin is also got an occupying force of the French, the Americans, and the English and the Russians.
Mm.
Well, the French, the Americans, and the English in West Berlin. And the Russians come in still once a day in a bus to provide a ceremonial guard for the Russian War Memorial, which is in West Berlin. So it's a very strange situation, and it's unlike any other city in the world, but it does have its own local government. And I have to say that on both sides, they've been unbelievably cooperative. I mean, nevertheless, it still took 5 months to get official permission through to be allowed to go ahead to do the show. Our original date for doing the show was June the 2nd, and we had to put it back over 6 weeks because we didn't get the permission, and therefore we passed our fail-safe point. But they've been very, very cooperative.
Physically, the site where you're performing the show is near the Brandenburg Gate, Potsdamer Platz, and near the site of the bunker that Hitler spent his last hours in before.
What's on it?
Yeah.
Well, I say it's on it. The bunker is in the area that the audience occupy. So if you come to the show, when you arrive there, if you're early, you'll see there's a mound, which I think will be the best seat in the house, and that's the entrance to the bunker.
Funny, it's something unique about the site as well, is that when I was in Berlin, and I came over for the press conference, as you know, to announce and launch the event, it seemed to me as if you had just awoken an area where time had stood still for the last two decades. They had cemented over, concreted and covered over history, and nobody was ever, as far as they were concerned, ever going to go back there and dig it up again.
Yeah. Well, we've dug the whole thing up. We had to, because there's lots of bombs and stuff, and so it's all been dug down to 5 meters, and they figure anything further than 5 meters down is not going to get disturbed to the point where it might get dangerous after 45 years. And we unearthed a new bunker 2 weeks ago, which is a pretty strange place, which was an SS kind of living quarters guardhouse place that had all kinds of weird SS murals all over the walls and rooms full of anti-tank ammunition and stuff. It's very spooky place to be, but maybe we can lay a few ghosts with the performance of this work there. And the fact that on site there will be West Germans and East Germans and Dutch and French and Italians and Englishmen and Americans and Japanese and Australians, and I mean, we're selling tickets everywhere.
Do you think the authorities, both East and West, see this as a sort of celebration? Have they, if you like, endorsed this and braced this as a celebration for themselves as well, the people of Berlin?
Well, I hope so, and I certainly think so. Yeah, because it would have been very easy for them to just go, no, right from the very outset, and they didn't. We had a few hiccups, but I think they're very pleased that it's happening, because all that news that's coming out of Germany at the moment, you know, in terms of the negotiations vis-a-vis reunification and all the economic plans that are being made and things, I think this maybe gives some of it a different focus that is useful to all of them, to the East Germans and West Germans. And in no sense is it meant to be a celebration of a victory of capitalism over socialism, because it isn't, and certainly that's not how I see it. And I'm glad to see that, as I watch my TV set from time to time these days, that that's beginning to come out now, that that's not what's going on in Eastern Europe, and that they're very proud of quite a lot of the social programs that they developed. Having said that, obviously, you know, they weren't very keen on living under the, you know, the heel of that of a non-democracy and totalitarian government like they had to.
When this show's over, and you regain your composure and your strength after the exhaustions of what is a fantastic project, the charity will go on and raise valuable funds. What will Roger Waters be doing career-wise?
Well, I'm in the middle of another album. I've got not thousands. I've got tens of songs, and I think I'm getting quite close to finishing the next album. In fact, I think it's very nearly finished now. But I should probably start work on that again in the fall, in the autumn, and maybe finish it by Christmas. Maybe put it out next year. I don't know. Maybe tour. Maybe not. We'll have to see.
You've dealt with different subjects in your last two albums, The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking and Radio Chaos. Mm. Where are we going this time? Have you an idea? Is there a conceptual idea this time or not?
Well, they all seem to be... Most of the songs seem to be about TV, either directly or peripherally. I got very involved in the idea of... A couple of years ago, I got very involved in the idea of foreign policy as entertainment. And a couple of songs are about that. And I found I've written some songs about, I don't know, there's one song about women and the making of promo videos. And there's another song about, what else are there songs about? Religion and TV, all sorts of things.
So you won't be wanting your MTV?
I've never been a great supporter of MTV. In fact, I've never supported it at all. I think the format is all wrong. Interestingly enough, I read an article that, not to that effect, but that mentioned that fact in the Sunday Times only today as I was browsing through it this morning.
That's the British Sunday Times, is it?
Or
the
New York Times? Yeah, the English Sunday Times. It's just talking about the last sort of 40 years of rock and roll. And successful as I've been, I find it very irritating as a format.
Really?
Individual pieces, short pieces of film set to music can be quite good, but it's the minute you put one after another after another after another after another after another, they all turn into a sort of grey blur for me. I know it's not the same for everybody. Well, which doesn't seem to happen on radio. It seems easier to listen to one song and then another and another.
We'll look forward to the results of the new album next year. Any sort of closing thoughts on the war? It's only 4 weeks to go now. There's a lot to be done. I know you've done a lot already. Sort of final thoughts on it?
About the
performance and your expectations personally?
No, I can only think details now. I'm just, you know, I my brain now works on this detail for 5 minutes, and then I move on to that detail for 5 minutes, and then occasionally, but only in terms of directing the show, do I get a chance, which I only get once a week, to call a meeting with the heads of all the creative departments who are taking part in the thing, and we get out the drawings of the model and the maps of the thing, and we look how far we are ahead with this and that and the other, and how the graphics coming on, and how the Pani projector software coming along, and are all the films done right? That's done okay, and then we go through the show yet again and say, okay, that fits. Now there's a strange area here where we need to plug a hole, or we need to change this or do that or something else. And then I can take an overview, and that's extremely enjoyable, but most of it is just a grind.
Well, I hope it becomes an enjoyable grind, and we'll look for, we'll.
I think on the day it'll be unforgettable. I mean, and I think most of the tickets have been sold now, but for the people who are there, it'll be something else.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Okay.
So we had like a personal connection with a couple of the people that appeared on stage.
Yeah.
I was shocked to see the Hooters because, you know, Denny and I are both from Philly and Hooters are a local band that if I was on Millionaire and they said, which one of these bands performed with, I would never have picked them, but there they were, babies at the time. And they did a great job, and I'm going to have to talk to them and find out, you know, how that all happened. You think you knew though, right?
Yeah, they were friends. And also even more surprising was the guitar player in Roger Waters' band who does the David Gilmour solo for Country B&M is a guy named Rick DeFonso, who we both know from another band out of Philly called the A's.
Yeah, I had no idea.
It was amazing.
I thought he was still playing at Dobbs, and there he was.
Now, you remember the Hooters also opened Live Aid.
Yeah, that I knew, but, you know, so it was in Philly.
They've had some pretty amazing billings.
Yeah, it was anyway. In Philly. And then Cyndi Lauper, of course, she and Rob, you know, wrote Time After Time together. So I thought maybe that was the connection.
Also the band.
Yeah.
The Hooters Rob and Eric, two of the members of the Hooters, backed the band on their reunion album. So well, I sort of think that might be where it came from.
Well, it was thrilling to see them. So it was a really fun time.
But we'll find out more when we have them on sometime. So anyway, I mentioned John Lodge of the Moody Blues, you know, the guy that wrote Ride My Seesaw, Just a Singer in a Rock and Roll Band, Isn't Life Strange. A lot of the songs along, you know, Justin is the other main writer, but he wrote a lot of the songs and sang a lot of them. And I ran into him not too long ago. So he told me he was working on this. And I said, well, give me a call when you're done, if you got something. So this is my conversation with him. And he explains a little bit about this new song. This is John Lodge from the Moody Blues. Thank you for joining us, by the way. It's good to see you.
Yeah, found you. Yeah, thank you.
Now, you've got a new digital single coming out, or has been released, actually, The Sun Will Shine.
Yeah.
Give me the story behind it, because I know you've been working on it during the lockdown, right?
Yeah, I finished my USA tour of 2020 in March the 10th. Up in Boston, I flew down to Naples to be with my family on my grandson's birthday. Never made the birthday because March the 12th we locked down. So I have a home here, but I didn't have a studio. I thought, what am I going to do? So lockdown, Amazon came to the rescue. I bought built a studio here, which I'm in now, and started writing songs. I thought it's taken me back to living in my bedroom when I was 14, learning to play the guitar, you know, right, hour after hour. And it was a bit like that, really. And I wrote a song called In These Crazy Times, on GarageBand. I finished it, did all of it here. My microphone for singing is in the wardrobe and, you know, usual paraphernalia. And that was about me. And it was about me and being locked down and suddenly realizing everybody in the world, basically, was in the same position, and what would they be thinking as well. And I wrote a few more songs. I released that single last year, and I was writing some more songs. And as I'm going through the lockdown, I thought, well, this can't last forever. You know, we've got to come out of this somehow. And I started to think, when you come out, what will it be like? And I thought, it's not going to be the same as we went into the lockdown. It can't be. Too many things have happened. The most important thing when we come out of this lockdown is be positive, really be positive. And I related to a new dawn, a new day. You know, the sun will shine. Will shine on everyone, will shine on me, and it will shine, providing you have a positive attitude. And if you have the attitude, if you're happy, people feed off that as well.
Tell me what you remember most about the making of Days of Future Past. Because that album almost didn't get made, right? Didn't you have to, do some stuff for Decca before they'd let you record?
Yeah, we did a lot of demos for Decca. We covered a lot of songs for them. What they wanted was a pop band that they had under contract to take Dvořák's New World Symphony, take the melodies and write new lyrics for it, because they wanted a sampler album to show their new full frequency recordings. So we made it, but we didn't do Dvořák. We used basically a stage show, which we'd been writing and rehearsing, and we knew it worked. We knew the songs worked. But when we played it back to the record company, it was like, oh, that's not what we want. They sort of really washed their hands of it. Until then, you had 3-hour sessions in the studio. So 10 to 1, 2 to 5, and 6 to 9 type of thing. Mm-hmm. And we said to the record company, if you're going to do that, we want 24-hour lockdown. And I think it's the first time any artist had ever said that to a record company. And the head of Decca Records, Sir Edward Lewis, said, yeah, go for it. And he gave us 24 hours a day for 7 days. And we made Days of Future Past in those 7 days on 2 4-track machines and a 2-track machine.
Knights in White Satin had came out, didn't really do anything the first time. It was then re-released a couple of years later, and then it really exploded, correct?
Yeah, it happened in Europe first time round, in France and Belgium. But then again, we released an album called Seventh Sojourn in 72, 73. And on the back of that, when that was out, Nights in White Satin, Days of Future Past, and just took off again.
Tell me something about Ride My Seesaw.
Ride My Seesaw is really about me growing up and trying to relate to world late teenagers, early 20s, you come into. Everything you've been taught at school, everything, is a great background, but it doesn't actually launch you on a platform into real life. And that was Ride My Seesaw. And it's the first time I've been traveling around the world, meeting young people of the same age as me and discussing what their life was about and my life was about. And, you know, I think when you're like 22, 23, 20, well, all through your life, it's ups and downs. Your life goes up and down, highs and lows.
Okay. What made you write "I'm Just a Singer in a Rock and Roll Band"? Was it a specific incident?
Yeah, because people, you know, at that time, a lot of the fans thought we knew the answers to everything. And I remember coming back from a tour, and those people literally camping outside my house. And I said, you know, "What you're doing is great, you know, but what you're doing," it said, "the world's going to be ending soon, and we were told you would fly the spaceship to rescue us all." I suddenly realized I've got to put this in order and say, "Hey, I don't know anything. So I'm just a singer of a rock and roll band, and I have no idea what's going on in the world."
What, by the way, is the current status of the Moody Blues? You're on hold, or have you broken up, or on hiatus? What's the story? Oh,
we've still got Threshold Records, which we are active in, obviously. But at this moment, you know, I'm a Moody Blue, always will be a Moody Blue. And that's why on the road, I'm playing old classic Moody Blues songs and paying tribute to Mike Pinder on the road, Ray Thomas on the road, and Justin on the road, because these songs have been part of my life forever. But as far as the Moody Blues are concerned, Justin doesn't run to tour now as the Moody Blues, so that's his prerogative. And so we're still all good friends, but that's what he doesn't want to do. So,
tell me what it was like the night you got inducted to the Hall of Fame.
During the day, it was pretty chaotic, to be honest. Everybody wanted a piece of you. I really didn't know what. I knew what was going on, but it was like a marketplace in a way. But the thing, what got to me was when I was actually on stage being presented with the award, what got to me was thinking, because I had no prepared script at all. I was just going to say what I thought. when they asked me before, "What are you going to say? Can we read your script first?" I said, "No, I don't work like that. You'll get what I say. I can't write things down. It's rubbish." So I went on stage and I thought, "Hey, I know we got this award, but really the fans have made this for us as well." While I was thinking that, I said, my hero was Buddy Holly. Always was Buddy Holly. And I was thinking to myself, here's Johnny Lodge from the council house in Birmingham. I'll be standing next to Buddy Holly in the Hall of Fame. How good is that, you know? And I started to get a wry smile thinking about it. And then I thought, you know, something else which is fantastic. When my grandson grows up and he's married and children, they wander through the Hall of Fame and he's going, "Hey, that was my granddad," you know. And I thought, yeah, it means something.
So that's John Lodge, the Moody Blues, giving you an update on what he's up to. And just so you know, when I last saw him, he was with his daughter, Emily, and she's dating John Davison, who's the current singer in Yes. So that's how he got to be the backup singer on this track that he's just released.
And Emily, of course, is Emily from Emily's Song.
Right.
And, you know, one of the best things for me about John Lodge is that he's been married to his wife, Kirsten, since 1968. So that's, you know, that's amazing. That is amazing. And he's got a son, Christian. Yeah. And Christian played, and his wife sang the backing vocals with John Davison, and Emily mm-hmm. managed the project.
There you go.
It's a family affair.
Definitely a family affair. And it was good to catch up with them. And Moody's are one of my favorite bands. So and then right after that, I got a note from Gary Brooker, and he was releasing. Gary Brooker is the legendary vocalist of Procol Harum. Of course, everybody knows Whiter Shade of Pale, one of my biggest songs of all time.
Yeah.
And he also did 3 tours with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. He's just been on the scene forever. And I've seen Procol Harum a number of times. So we talked about his new EP and also what he's going to be doing. And of course, we talked about some classic songs. So I hope you enjoyed these three interviews from the archives. So anyway, how you doing?
Well, you know, I'm fine. I'm perfectly ready to have a little chat here.
Okay. Now, where are you in England?
I'm in Guildford.
Guildford. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good.
30 miles southwest of London.
Right. Okay. So yeah. I got to tell you, I listened to the new EP. It's real. Got the classic Procol Harum sound. And I know you said that it was written a few years ago. I mean, what's the genesis of it?
Well, it's sort of the genesis of it works backwards in that, well, it was actually the end of March now. I've been having a big clear out because, you know, we're locked down here. We still are to a certain extent.
Right.
But locked down, you know, you can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. You can't go and see anybody. So you start going through your CDs. And then going through those, I found these two. I thought, well, I was looking for that. I hadn't heard that. What's that like? Well, that was Missing Persons. And I put it on, and it said a rough mix, but it sounded, well, it didn't sound, well, it's a very, very good rough mix. You know, the vocals sounded good. Everything seemed to be there, actually, you know, drum sound and everything. And the other one was next to it, the War Is Not Healthy. And that sounded, that's a bit lively, you know. But I didn't really remember doing them. And I couldn't figure out why they'd got to that stage and then got forgotten. When I say they weren't very old, they weren't very old. But that's all a bit relative to how fast time goes by.
Mm.
But they were done, I know they were done prior to we had an album called Novum, which we did in 2016, came out in 2017. And I know these were before that.
You used to play this live, right? In the 2014 tour. I saw you do it.
Oh, yeah, well, I can't remember that.
You don't remember doing it live?
No, I don't remember doing
it. Well, go to YouTube and you'll see it.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember recording it either.
2014, it says in New York, recorded.
2014?
Live. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was it was written before that.
Well, good information for you to know, right? Nobody else caught that?
No. I think if you look on the EP, it probably says made somewhere in time instead of a date. The point was that it sounded, well, these are Keith Reid's words as well.
Right.
It sounded like that it had been written for the current situation a bit, Missing Persons. I just thought it was very appropriate. I said, well, let's get this out. You know, we'll have the War Is Not Healthy. That's always, that's always true, isn't it?
Mm.
So that's it. So, we rushed it out. But, you know.
You're scheduled to start touring in September. Is that definite or is that still up in the air?
Well, I've got to get over a couple of health problems. Once I get those out of the way, I'll know if I'll be here or not.
Okay. Well, we hope it's nothing serious.
I'm still getting tested, so I don't quite know.
Okay.
But I hope everything's fine. But it has caused us to, we have a couple of things coming up quite soon, and I know I won't be able to do them. You know, there's early July in mm-hmm. London and Estonia, I think, at the beginning of August. But we're holding the other ones at the moment.
Did you ever play in Estonia before?
Yes, we've played there quite a few times.
What's that like, playing in Estonia?
it's a nice place. You know, it's a, there's three Baltic states.
Right.
I'm never sure what order, but at the top's Estonia. It's more or less opposite Helsinki, across from Finland, across some sort of sea. Don't know if it's Baltic Sea or not.
Right.
And they're very friendly there. We first went there quite a few years ago, played at a festival, and they liked us. We liked them, and I think we've been back four or five times since. I mean, I played there on my own once at a special deal with an Estonian orchestra and choir. So they're very keen on their music, and it's a nice place. They're nice people.
So let me ask you: are you a vinyl guy or a CD guy?
I've still got my vinyl collection.
What's in your vinyl collection?
Oh, it's priceless.
Okay.
It probably dates from 1967 to about 1970. And I went to clear it out. It's got to be, I don't know how many feet, but it's got to be 30, 40, or 50 feet of linear vinyl. You know, so it's a lot of albums.
It's a few thousand.
Counted them.
It's a few thousand.
But we actually moved for the first time a few, you know, four, five, 6 years ago. And I thought, right, I'll clear out my vinyl, you know, carting this lot around.
Right.
And so I thought I'd probably throw away half of them. And out of it, no idea how many are, but I sorted out 12 that I didn't want. And I think two of those were Keep Fit records by Jane Fonda's.
Well, what are your like top five classic vinyl records that you remember getting, playing? It's still sitting there. You may not have played it in a while, but if somebody said, you know, you can keep a few of these, but I'll buy the rest, what are they going to be?
Well, the trouble is, it'd be 300 of them. But I loved and still love Leo Kottke's first album.
Right.
Which was, I think, called 6 and 12 String Guitar.
Yeah.
That was marvelous, and still is.
Mm-hmm.
Reading it, it sounded like this guy had existed in about 1870 or something, you see. And I thought, wow. And then one day we're in Boston, I'm walking past a club on a night off, and I see in lights Leo Kottke. But he's dead. I thought, what? So I went in, and there he is, the man himself playing all this stuff. And we became lifelong friends, actually. Anyway, he is definitely on my playlist. Well, most of them were great albums.
Yeah.
A lot of them were the first albums by people. A lot of them were quite rare, you know, like Blind Faith, their first and only album, I think.
Right.
Where there was a naked sort of 13-year-old or topless on the front holding an aircraft.
Yes.
And that got actually banned. And so it didn't exist for very long, but I got it as soon as it came out. And so I got that original one. I saw that, so I think you peeled this banana skin. There was a banana inside it. Andy Warhol, Velvet Underground, I think.
Right.
And, you know, the Stones one with a zip on the front. Was it Sticky Fingers? Could have been.
Right. Now, is it? It's true that you made your debut in London at a concert that Brian Epstein promoted. Is that correct? You opened for Hendrix.
Oh yeah, I remember that now. Yeah.
What can you tell me about it? Was that seeing Hendrix for the first time? Did you get to see him?
Oh yeah. Well, actually, prior to that, he'd just been around for a month or two in London. And I did see him on the other side of the street once, and I just saw this thing. I will say thing because of what he was dressed like and what it looked like.
Right.
Some alien thing. And I thought, that must be Jimi Hendrix I've heard about. I hadn't heard him play a note yet. Before we played at this, and that was at the Savoy Theatre, I think, that gig you're mentioning.
Yes.
But we had played at a little club called the Speakeasy just to work out our repertoire with Broquan. And Jimi Hendrix he got up and jammed with us. He took one look at Robin Trower and didn't fancy grabbing Robin's guitar off him. So he grabbed the bass off of Dave Knight. And of course, he was a left-hander, Jimmy. And so he still played it wrong way around, upside down. But he played the bass with us, not the guitar. But he was fun. So we sort of knew him to say, you know, to talk to.
Yeah.
And it was nice to play with him at this one here. It was the first time I'd seen him in his own situation. He had decided that he was going to do Sergeant Pepper,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, had only just come out, even that morning or something, you know. And he hammered that out because he liked the Beatles and he liked that one, and he did a great version of it.
Was that the show? I don't even know if you're aware, but that's the show where Hendrix played Sergeant Pepper, and it had only been out for a few days, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, John and Paul and George were in the audience. You aware of that?
Oh, no, I don't even remember them.
Yeah, in fact,
I didn't see them backstage.
George, I don't know if they would have gone backstage or not, but George actually, years later, because I talked to him about it, he did, you know, the record had just come out and they saw Hendrix and they go, oh, we got to recall the record and redo it. And Brian said, no, it's too late. It's out.
Yeah. It was probably a very, very top concert to go to on the day.
Yeah.
Because you got Jimi Hendrix, you got Procol Harum, who just popped out of nowhere and got a number one record.
So let me talk to you. Okay. So you played in a couple of Ringo Starr's all-star bands, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. How did that come about?
So, he asked me to do it. I said, who else is in it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, no disrespect, because Ringo's a lovely man. But, you just think, well, who else? I knew that he did these things, and he had lots of different people. And this particular one, he was basing it, I think, on a British thing.
Right.
So it was all Brits. Of course, he's British. And then so was Jack Bruce, so was Simon Kirk on the drums, so was Peter Frampton, and myself. So that was his kind of British tour, and we did it in America.
Yeah.
But it was great. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I stayed with him actually. Did it over about 3 years.
Wow.
Did two more tours.
Did you ever play with any of the other Beatles?
Only George Harrison and Paul McCartney, not with John Lennon.
Right. Yeah, with George, were you on All Things Must Pass?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you play on? What do you remember what you played on that?
Well, I was playing the piano, and I get mixed up. Is that his first album?
Yes. The three.
I was
three,
on
three record set.
Yeah. Wah Wah and My Sweet Lord. I remember doing those.
Right. Let's talk about some of the classic Procol Harum tunes and albums. A Salty Dog, which is definitely a little bit of a change from the first album.
I think we'd started to feel our way a bit more as a Procol Harum band, as, you know, in fact, people liked us and people were listening to our music. So the time we did A Salty Dog, we knew that people were actually listening to us and wanted to hear us and wanted to come and see us. And that gives you, of course, a lot of confidence and a lot of justification to keep going, you know. But we're still trying to do different things, you know. I think the most different thing on there probably was doing one, as in the title song, which was just used as string orchestra. Very little Procol Harum band in it, except for B.J. Wilson's magnificent drum intro. But apart from that, it was just piano and string orchestra and the vocal.
Where did you meet Keith Reid?
Way back in 1966. We had a mutual friend whose name was Guy Stevens, God rest his soul. But he one day introduced me round his place to Keith Reid. He said, Gary, this is Keith. He writes words. Keith, this is Gary. He writes music. We got along fine. He gave me a packet of lyrics, which I took home and forgot about, but found them a couple of months later. I just read through them and I wrote some songs to them. I thought they were intriguing, his lyrics, and I wrote some songs. And then we got together. He liked what I'd done, and we were off.
Okay, so it's it was right around this time, May 12th, I believe, in 1967, that A Whiter Shade of Pale came out.
Yeah.
And did the lyrics come first or the music?
Well, like many of our songs that Keith and I wrote, it was neither one thing nor the other. I was actually sitting at home working on this musical idea. It was in the morning, nothing, you know, smoky or dark about it. It was in the morning, and I'd been working. I thought, this is a good idea I've got here. It had a bit of bark-like, and then it got into this cycle of going round and round with the chords, and I'm humming and hawing over it, and it's working fine, you know, as an idea. And then the postman came, and I opened up my mail. There's an envelope from Keith. And the first thing I took out was this, what looked like an enormously long, his lyrics, his prose, whatever it's called. And when I put it on the piano, I started singing it. And my musical idea was just as long as his lyrical idea was. So there was no, I didn't get to the end of my song halfway through his lyric, halfway through his verse. It went right through, and they both sat there very nicely together. But it was quite organic.
And now it's one of the biggest selling singles of all time.
Yeah, I think so.
You think so? Okay.
Very played.
What happened with the lawsuit over Whiter Shade of Pale? Because originally you won, it got overturned, and then it got overturned again.
Well, that's it. But, you know, that's where we are. That's where we are now. You know, that was, to me, a long time ago. It's in the past. And I just look forward, really.
Okay.
So it just meant there's certain people I don't talk to.
Okay.
Most of them are lawyers.
Well, listen, I want to thank you for your time. Wish you a lot of luck. This is a great sounding EP. You're back to the Procol Harum sound that we all love. I've seen you many times over the years. Good luck with the new EP. I hope you your health is fine so that you go out and tour and we get to see you again. And I don't mean in Estonia. I mean in the United States.
Oh yeah, we'll be back. We're alive forever, so we'll be there.
Okay, Gary Brooker, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Danny. Right. Bye.
This is The Rock Podcast. And if you want to get in touch with us, we have a Facebook page. We're on Instagram. We have a website at therockpodcast.com. Or you can send us an email, hello@therockpodcast.com. We read everything and we enjoy hearing from you. So
yeah, we'll get back to you.
Yeah.
Follow
and
us.
We take some suggestions. We're going to do something. Guy wanted to rush. Believe me, I'm going through the archives. Got plenty of rush, but we'll get to it. So anything you want to recommend, please feel free. Anyway, that's
somebody
it for
said
me.
Little feet. Somebody said little feet.
Okay. We'll get to
we'll look into it.
We'll look into it. All right, everybody. Bye-bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any fantasy points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.